This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Loving What Is, Four Questions That Can Change Your Life by Byron Katie and Stephen Mitchell. Read for you by the authors with McLeod Andrews and Rebecca Lohman.
Introduction. The more clearly you understand yourself and your emotions, the more you become a lover of what is. Baruch Spinoza. The first time I watched the work, I realized that I was witnessing something truly remarkable. What I saw was a succession of people, young and old, educated and uneducated, who were learning to question their own thoughts, the thoughts that were most painful to them. With the lovingly incisive help of Byron Katie, everyone calls her Katie, these people were finding their way not only toward the resolution of their immediate problems, but also toward a state of mind in which the deepest questions are resolved. I've spent a good part of my life studying and translating the classic texts of the great spiritual traditions, and I recognize something very similar in process here. At the core of these traditions, in works such as the Book of Job, the Tao Te Ching, and the Bhagavad Gita, there is an intense questioning about life and death, and a profound, joyful wisdom that emerges as an answer. That wisdom, it seemed to me, was the place Katie was standing in, and the direction where these people were headed. As I watched from my seat in a crowded community center, five men and women, one after another, were learning freedom through the very thoughts that had caused their suffering. Thoughts such as, my husband betrayed me, or my mother doesn't love me enough. Simply by asking four questions and listening to the answers they found inside themselves, these people were opening their minds to profound, spacious, and life-transforming insights. I saw a man who had been suffering for decades from anger and resentment toward his alcoholic father, light up before my eyes within 45 minutes. I saw a woman who had been almost too frightened to speak because she had just found out that her cancer was spreading, end the session in a glow of understanding and acceptance. Three out of the five people had never done the work before, yet the process didn't seem to be more difficult for them than it was for the other two. Nor were their realizations any less profound. They all began by realizing a truth so basic that it is usually invisible. The fact that, in the words of the Greek philosopher Epictetus, we are disturbed not by what happens to us, but by our thoughts about what happens. As soon as they grasped that truth, their whole understanding changed. Before people have experienced the work of Byron Katie for themselves, they often think that it is too simple to be effective. But its simplicity is precisely what makes it so effective. Over the past 2 years, since Katie and I first met, we are now married, I have done the work many times on thoughts I hadn't even been aware of. And I've watched more than 1,000 people do it in public events across the United States and Europe. On the whole gamut of human problems, from major illnesses, the deaths of parents and children, sexual and psychological abuse, addictions, financial insecurity, professional problems, and social issues, to the usual frustrations of daily life. Again and again, I've seen the work quickly and radically transform the way people think about their problems. And as the thinking changes, the problems disappear. Suffering is optional, Katie says. When we experience a stressful feeling, anything from mild discomfort to intense sorrow, rage, or despair, we can be certain that there is a specific thought causing our reaction, whether or not we are conscious of it. The way to end our stress is to investigate the thinking that lies behind it, and anyone can do this by himself with a piece of paper and a pen. The work's four questions, which you will see in context later in this introduction, reveal where our thinking isn't true for us. Through this process, Katie also calls it inquiry, we discover that all the concepts and judgments that we believe or take for granted are distortions of things as they really are. When we believe our thoughts instead of what is really true for us, we experience the kinds of emotional distress that we call suffering. Suffering is a natural alarm, warning us that we're attaching to a thought. When we don't listen, we come to accept this suffering as an inevitable part of life. It's not. The work has striking similarities with the Zen koan and the Socratic dialogue, but it doesn't stem from any tradition, Eastern or Western. It is American, homegrown, and mainstream, having originated in the mind of an ordinary woman who had no intention of originating anything. To realize your true nature, you must wait for the right moment and the right conditions. When the time comes, you are awakened as if from a dream. You understand that what you have found is your own and doesn't come from anywhere outside. Buddhist Sutra. The work was born on a February morning in 1986 when Byron Kathleen Reed, a 43-year-old woman from a small town in the high desert of Southern California, woke up on the floor of a halfway house. In the midst of an ordinary life, two marriages, three children, a successful career, Katie had entered a 10-year-long downward spiral into rage, paranoia, and despair. For 2 years, she was so depressed that she could seldom manage to leave her house. She stayed in bed for weeks at a time, doing business by telephone from her bedroom, unable even to bathe or brush her teeth. Her children would tiptoe past her door to avoid her outbursts of rage. Finally, she checked into a halfway house for women with eating disorders, the only facility that her insurance company would pay for. The other residents were so frightened of her that she was placed alone in an attic room. One morning, a week or so later, as she lay on the floor, she had been feeling too unworthy to sleep in a bed, Katie woke up without any concepts of who or what she was. "There was no me," she says. "All my rage, all the thoughts that had been troubling me, my whole world, the whole world, was gone." At the same time, laughter welled up from the depths and just poured out. Everything was unrecognizable. It was as if something else had woken up. It opened its eyes. It was looking through Katie's eyes. And it was so delighted. It was intoxicated with joy. There was nothing separate, nothing unacceptable to it. Everything was its very own self. When Katie returned home, her family and friends felt that she was a different person. Her daughter, Roxanne, who was 16 at the time, says, "We knew that the constant storm was over. She had always yelled at me and my brothers and criticized us. I used to be scared to be in the same room with her. Now she seemed completely peaceful. She would sit still for hours on the window seat or out in the desert. She was joyful and innocent like a child, and she seemed to be filled with love. People in trouble started knocking on our door, asking her for help. She'd sit with them and ask them questions, mainly, 'Is it true?' When I'd come home miserable with a problem like, 'My boyfriend doesn't love me anymore,' Mom would look at me as if she knew that wasn't possible, and she'd ask me, 'Honey, how could that be true?' As if I had just told her that we were living in China. Once people understood that the old Katie wasn't coming back, they began to speculate about what had happened to her. Had some miracle occurred? She wasn't much help to them. It was a long time before she could describe her experience intelligibly. She would talk about a freedom that had woken up inside her. She also said that through an inner questioning, she had realized that all her old thoughts were untrue. Shortly after Katie got back from the halfway house, her home began to fill with people who had heard about her and had come to learn. She was able to communicate her inner inquiry in the form of specific questions that anyone who wanted freedom could apply on his own without her. Soon she began to be invited to meet with small gatherings in people's living rooms. Her hosts often asked her if she was enlightened. She would answer, I'm just someone who knows the difference between what hurts and what doesn't. In 1992, she was invited to Northern California, and the work spread very fast from there. Katie accepted every invitation. She's been on the road almost constantly since 1993, demonstrating the work in church basements, community centers, and hotel meeting rooms, in front of small and large audiences. And the work has found its way into all kinds of organizations, from corporations, law firms, and therapists' offices, to hospitals, prisons, churches, and schools. It is now popular in other parts of the world where Katie has traveled. All across America and Europe, there are groups of people who meet regularly to do the work. Katie often says that the only way to understand the work is to experience it. But it's worth noting that inquiry fits precisely with current research into the biology of mind. Contemporary neuroscience identifies a particular part of the brain, sometimes called the interpreter, as the source of the familiar internal narrative that gives us our sense of self. Two prominent neuroscientists have recently characterized the quirky, undependable quality of the tale told by the interpreter. Antonio Damasio describes it this way. Perhaps the most important revelation is precisely this, that the left cerebral hemisphere of humans is prone to fabricating verbal narratives that do not necessarily accord with the truth. And Michael Gazzaniga writes, the left brain weaves its story in order to convince itself and you that it is in full control. What is so adaptive about having what amounts to a spin doctor in the left brain? The interpreter is really trying to keep our personal story together. To do that, we have to learn to lie to ourselves. These insights, based on solid experimental work, show that we tend to believe our own press releases. Often when we think we're being rational, we're being spun by our own thinking. That trait explains how we get ourselves into the painful positions that Katie recognized in her own suffering. The self-questioning, she discovered, uses a different, less known capacity of the mind to find a way out of its self-made trap. After doing the work, many people report an immediate sense of release and freedom from thoughts that were making them miserable. But if the work depended on a momentary experience, it would be far less useful than it is. The work is an ongoing and deepening process of self-realization, not a quick fix. It's more than a technique, Katie says. It brings to life, from deep within us, an innate aspect of our being. The deeper you go into the work, the more powerful you realize it is. People who have been practicing inquiry for a while often say, the work is no longer something I do. It is doing me. They describe how, without any conscious intention, the mind notices each stressful thought and undoes it before it can cause any suffering. Their internal argument with reality has disappeared, and they find that what remains is love. Love for themselves, for other people, and for whatever life brings. The title of this book describes their experience. Loving what is becomes as easy and natural as breathing. Considering that, all hatred driven hence, the mind recovers radical innocence and learns at last that it is self-delighting, self-appeasing, self-affrighting, and that its own sweet will is heaven's will. William Butler Yeats. I've waited until now to introduce the four questions to you because they don't make much sense out of context. The best way to meet them is to see how they function in an actual example of the work. You'll also meet what Katie calls the turnaround, which is a way of experiencing the opposite of what you believe is true. The following dialogue with Katie took place before an audience of about 200 people. Mary, the woman who is sitting opposite Katie on the stage, has filled out a one-page worksheet that asked her to write down her thoughts about someone who upsets her. The instructions are, allow yourself to be as judgmental and petty as you really feel. Don't try to be spiritual or kind. The pettier we can be when writing, the more likely it is that we'll benefit from the work. You'll see that Mary hasn't held back at all. She is a forceful woman, perhaps 40 years old, slim, attractive, and dressed in expensive-looking exercise clothes. At the beginning of the dialogue, her anger and impatience are palpable. A first experience of the work as a reader or onlooker can be uncomfortable. It helps to remember that all the participants, Mary, Katie, and the audience, are on the same side here. All of them are looking for the truth. If Katie ever seems to be mocking or derisive, you'll realize upon closer examination that she's making fun of the thought that is causing Mary's suffering, never of Mary herself. Toward the middle of the dialogue, when Katie asks, "Do you really want to know the truth?" she doesn't mean her truth or any abstract, predetermined truth, but Mary's truth, the truth that is hidden behind her troubling thoughts. Mary has entered the dialogue in the first place because she trusts that Katie can help her discover where she is lying to herself. She welcomes Katie's persistence. You'll also notice right away that Katie is very free in her use of terms of endearment. One CEO, before a workshop that Katie gave to his top executives, felt that he had to issue a warning. "If she holds your hand and calls you sweetheart or honey, please don't get excited. She does this with everyone."
"I hate my husband because he drives me crazy. Everything about him, including the way he breathes. What disappoints me is that I don't love him anymore and our relationship is a charade. I want him to be more successful, to not want to have sex with me, to get in shape, to get a life outside of me and the children, to not touch me anymore, and to be powerful. My husband shouldn't fool himself that he's good at our business. He should create more success. My husband is a wimp. He's needy and lazy. He's fooling himself. I refuse to keep living a lie. I refuse to keep living my relationship as an imposter."
Does that pretty well sum it up? By the sound of the laughter, it seems as though you speak for a lot of people in this room. So let's start at the top and see if we can begin to understand what's going on.
"I hate my husband because he drives me crazy. Everything about him, including the way he breathes."
Your husband drives you crazy, is it true?
This is the first of the four questions. Is it true?
Yes.
Okay, what's an example of that, sweetheart? He breathes?
He breathes. When we're doing conference calls for our business, I can hear his breath on the other end of the telephone and I want to scream.
So his breath drives you crazy, is that true?
Yes.
Can you absolutely know that it's true?
The second question, can you absolutely know that it's true?
Yes.
We can all relate to that. I hear that it really is true for you. In my experience, it can't be your husband's breath that's driving you crazy. It has to be your thoughts about his breath that are driving you crazy. So let's take a look and see if that's true. What are your thoughts about his breath on the phone?
That he should be more aware that he's breathing loudly during a conference call.
How do you react when you think that thought?
The third question. How do you react when you think that thought?
I feel like I want to kill him.
So what's more painful, the thought you attach to about his breathing or his breathing?
The breathing is more painful. I'm comfortable with the thought that I want to kill him.
You can keep that thought. That's the beautiful thing about the work. You can keep all your thoughts.
I've never done the work before, so I don't know any of the right answers.
Your answers are perfect, sweetheart. Don't rehearse. So he's breathing on the phone, and you have the thought that he should be more aware, and he's not. What's the next thought?
It brings up every terrible thought I have about him.
Okay, and he's still breathing. He should stop breathing into the phone on the conference call. What's the reality of it, does he?
No. I've told him to stop.
And he still does it. That's reality. What's true is always what's happening, not the story about what should be happening. He should stop breathing on the phone. Is it true?
No, it's not true. He's doing it. That's what's true. That's reality.
So how do you react when you think the thought he should stop breathing on the phone and he doesn't?
How do I react? I want out. It feels uncomfortable because I know I want out and I know I'm not going anywhere.
So let's move back to inquiry, honey. Rather than moving further into your story, your interpretation of what's happening. Do you really want to know the truth?
Yes.
Okay. It helps if we stick to one written statement at a time. Can you see a reason to drop the thought that he should stop breathing on the phone?
This is an additional question that Katie sometimes asks.
For those of you new to the work, if you hear that I'm asking Mary to drop her story, let me make it very clear I'm not. This is not about getting rid of thoughts or about overcoming, improving, or surrendering them. None of that. This is about realizing for yourself internal cause and effect. The question is simply, can you see a reason to drop the thought?
Yes, I can. It would be a lot more enjoyable to do conference calls without this thought.
That's a good reason. Can you find a stress-free reason to keep this thought, this lie that he should stop breathing on the phone?
A second additional question.
No.
Who would you be without that thought?
The fourth question, who would you be without the thought?
Who would you be while you're on a conference call with your husband if you didn't have the ability to think that thought?
I'd be much happier. I'd be more powerful. I wouldn't be distracted.
Yes, sweetheart, that's it. It's not his breathing that is causing your problem, it's your thoughts about his breathing, because you haven't investigated them to see that they oppose reality in the moment. Let's look at your next statement.
I don't love him anymore.
Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, good. I hear that. And do you really want to know the truth?
Yes.
Okay, be still. There's no right or wrong answer. You don't love him. Is that true? Take your time. If you had to answer honestly, either yes or no, right now, and you had to live forever with your answer, your truth or your lie, what would your answer be? You don't love him. Is that true?
No. It's not true.
That's a very courageous answer. If we answer it that way, with what's really true for ourselves, we think that there may be no way out. Is it true? Is just a question. We're terrified to answer the simplest question honestly, because we project what that may mean in the imagined future. We think we have to do something about it. How do you react when you believe the thought that you don't love him?
It makes my whole life a stupid charade.
Can you see a reason to drop this thought that you don't love him? And I'm not asking you to drop the thought.
Yes, I can see a reason to drop it.
Can you think of one stress-free reason to keep the thought?
I think if I keep my story, then I can keep him from wanting to have sex all the time.
Is that a stress-free reason? It seems stressful to me.
I guess it is.
Can you find one stress-free reason to keep that thought?
Oh, I see. No, there aren't any stress-free reasons to keep the story.
Fascinating. Who would you be standing with your husband without the thought that you don't love him?
It would be great. It would be fabulous. That's what I want.
I'm hearing that with the thought it's stressful and without the thought it's fabulous. So what does your husband have to do with your unhappiness? We're just noticing here. So, I don't love my husband, turn it around.
After the four questions comes the turnaround.
I do love my husband.
So feel it. It has nothing to do with him, does it?
No, it really doesn't. I do love my husband, and you're right, it doesn't have anything to do with him.
And sometimes you think you hate him, and that doesn't have anything to do with him either. The man's just breathing. You tell the story that you love him, or you tell the story that you hate him. It doesn't take two people to have a happy marriage. It only takes one, you. There's another turnaround.
I don't love myself. I can relate to that one.
And you may think that if you divorce him, then you'll feel good. But if you haven't investigated your thinking, you'll attach these same concepts onto whoever comes into your life next. We don't attach to people or to things. We attach to uninvestigated concepts that we believe to be true in the moment. Let's look at the next statement on your worksheet.
I want my husband not to be needy, not to be dependent on me, to be more successful, to not want to have sex with me, to get in shape, to get a life outside of me and the children, and to be more powerful. Those are just a few.
So let's turn that statement around.
I want me not to be needy. I want me not to be dependent on him. I want me to be more successful. I want me to want to have sex with him. I want me to get into shape. I want me to get a life outside of him and the children. I want me to be more powerful.
So, he shouldn't be needy, is it true? What's the reality of it, is he?
He's needy.
He shouldn't be needy is a lie because the guy is needy according to you. So how do you react when you think the thought he shouldn't be needy? And in your reality, he is needy.
I just want to run away all the time.
Who would you be in his presence without the thought he shouldn't be needy?
What I just understood is that I could be with him in a space of love instead of just having my defenses up. It's like if I notice any bit of neediness, I'm out of there. I've got to run. That's what I do with my life.
When he's acting needy, in your opinion, you don't say no honestly. You run away or want to run away instead of being honest with yourself and him.
That's true.
Well, it would have to be. You have to call him needy until you can get some clarity and honest communication going with yourself. So let's be clear. You be him and be very needy. I'll take the role of clarity.
Mr. Needy comes in and says, I just had the best phone call. You've got to hear about it. It was this guy and he's going to be fabulous in the business. And I had another call. You know, he just goes on and on. Meanwhile, I'm busy. I've got a deadline.
Sweetheart, I hear that you had a wonderful phone call. I love that, and I would also like you to leave the room now. I have a deadline to meet.
We have to talk about our plans. When are we going to Hawaii? We have to figure out what airlines.
I hear that you want to talk about our plans for Hawaii, so let's discuss this at dinner tonight. I really want you to leave the room now. I have a deadline to meet.
If one of your girlfriends called, you would talk to her for an hour. Now you can't listen to me for 2 minutes?
You could be right, and I want you to leave the room now. It may sound cold, but it's not. I just have a deadline to meet.
I don't do it like that. Usually I'm mean to him. I just seethe.
You have to be mean because you're afraid to tell the truth and say no. You don't say, sweetheart, I would like you to leave. I have a deadline. Because you want something from him. What scam are you running on yourself and on him? What do you want from him?
I am never straightforward with anybody.
Because you want something from us. What is it?
I can't stand when somebody doesn't like me. I don't want disharmony.
So you want our approval?
Yes, and I want to maintain harmony.
Sweetheart, if your husband approves of what you say and what you do, then there is harmony in your home. Is that true? Does it work? Is there harmony in your home?
No.
You trade your integrity for harmony in the home. It doesn't work. Spare yourself from seeking love, approval, or appreciation from anyone, and watch what happens in reality just for fun. Read your statement again.
I want my husband not to be needy.
All right, turn it around.
I want me not to be needy.
Yes, you need all this harmony. You need his approval. You need his breathing to change. You need his sexuality to change for you. Who's the needy one? Who is dependent on whom? So let's turn the whole list around.
I want myself not to be needy, not to be dependent.
On your husband, perhaps?
I want myself to be more successful. I want myself to not want to have sex with me.
That one could be really legitimate if you sit with it. How many times do you tell the story of how he has sex with you and you hate it?
Constantly.
Yes, you're having sex with him in your mind and thinking how terrible that is. You tell the story over and over of what it's like having sex with your husband. That story is what's repelling you, not your husband. Sex without a story has never repelled anyone. It just is what it is. You're having sex or you're not. It's our thoughts about sex that repel us. Write that one out too, honey. You could write a whole worksheet on your husband and sexuality.
I get it.
Okay, so turn the next statement around.
I want me to get in shape, but I am in shape.
Oh, really? How about mentally?
Oh, I could work on that.
Are you doing the best that you can?
Yes.
Well, maybe he is too. He's supposed to be in shape, is that true?
No, he's not in shape.
How do you react when you believe the thought that he should be in shape and he's not? How do you treat him? What do you say? What do you do?
Everything is subtle. I show him my muscles. I don't ever look at him with approval. I don't ever admire him. I don't ever do anything kind in that direction.
Okay, close your eyes. Look at yourself looking at him that way. Now look at his face. Keep your eyes closed. Look at him again. Who would you be standing there with him without the thought that he should be in shape?
I would look at him and see how handsome he is.
Yes, Angel. And you'd see how much you love him. Isn't that fascinating? This is very exciting. So let's just be there a moment. Look at how you treat him. And he still wants to go to Hawaii with you. That's amazing.
What's amazing about this guy is that I am so horrible and mean, and he loves me without conditions. It drives me nuts.
He drives you nuts, is that true?
No. So far, it's been my thinking that drives me nuts.
So let's go back. He should get in shape. Turn it around.
I should get in shape. I should get my thinking in shape.
Yes. Every time you look at him and are repulsed, get your thinking in shape. Judge your husband, write it down, ask for questions, and turn it around, but only if you're tired of the pain. Okay, honey, I think you've got it. Just continue through the rest of the statements on your worksheet in the same manner. I love sitting with you. And welcome to inquiry. Welcome to the work.
Step aside from all thinking, and there is nowhere you can't go. Sang Tsan, the third founding teacher of Zen. In Loving What Is, Katie has given you everything you need in order to do the work by yourself or with others. The book will guide you step by step through the whole process, and along the way, it will show you many people doing the work directly with Katie. These one-on-one dialogues, in which Katie brings her clarity to the most complicated human problems, are examples, dramatic examples, some of them, of how ordinary people can find their own freedom through inquiry. Stephen Mitchell.
The work is merely four questions. It's not even a thing. It has no motive, no strings. It's nothing without your answers. These four questions will join any program you've got and enhance it. Any religion you have, they'll enhance it. If you have no religion, they will bring you joy. And they'll burn up anything that isn't true for you. They'll burn through to the reality that has always been waiting. We are entering the dimension where we have control, the inside. Chapter 1. A Few Basic Principles. What I love about the work is that it allows you to go inside and find your own happiness, to experience what already exists within you, unchanging, immovable, ever-present, ever-waiting. No teacher is necessary. You are the teacher you've been waiting for. You are the one who can end your own suffering. I often say, don't believe anything I say. I want you to discover what's true for you, not for me. Still, many people have found the following principles to be helpful for getting started in the work. Noticing when your thoughts argue with reality. The only time we suffer is when we believe a thought that argues with what is. When the mind is perfectly clear, what is what we want. If you want reality to be different than it is, you might as well teach a cat to bark. You can try and try, and in the end, the cat will look up at you and say, meow. Wanting reality to be different than it is hopeless. You can spend the rest of your life trying to teach a cat to bark. And yet, if you pay attention, you'll notice that you think thoughts like this dozens of times a day. People should be kinder. Children should be well-behaved. My neighbors should take better care of their lawn. The line at the grocery store should move faster. My husband or wife should agree with me. I should be thinner or prettier or more successful. These thoughts are ways of wanting reality to be different than it is. If you think that this sounds depressing, you're right. All the stress that we feel is caused by arguing with what is. After I woke up to reality in 1986, people often referred to me as the woman who made friends with the wind. Barstow is a desert town where the wind blows a lot of the time, and everyone hated it. People even moved from there because they couldn't stand the wind. The reason I made friends with the wind, with reality, is that I discovered I didn't have a choice. I realized that it's insane to oppose it. When I argue with reality, I lose, but only 100% of the time. How do I know that the wind should blow? It's blowing. People new to the work often say to me, but it would be disempowering to stop my argument with reality. If I simply accept reality, I'll become passive. I may even lose the desire to act. I answer them with a question, can you really know that that's true? Which is more empowering? I wish I hadn't lost my job, or I lost my job, what can I do now? The work reveals that what you think shouldn't have happened should have happened. It should have happened because it did, and no thinking in the world can change it. This doesn't mean that you condone it or approve of it. It just means that you can see things without resistance and without the confusion of your inner struggle. No one wants their children to get sick. No one wants to be in a car accident. But when these things happen, how can it be helpful to mentally argue with them? We know better than to do that, yet we do it, because we don't know how to stop. I'm a lover of what is, not because I'm a spiritual person, but because it hurts when I argue with reality. We can know that reality is good just as it is, because when we argue with it, we experience tension and frustration. We don't feel natural or balanced. When we stop opposing reality, action becomes simple, fluid, kind, and fearless. Staying in your own business. I can find only three kinds of business in the universe: mine, yours, and God's. For me, the word God means reality. Reality is God because it rules. Anything that's out of my control, your control, or everyone else's control, I call that God's business. Much of our stress comes from mentally living out of our own business. When I think, you need to get a job, I want you to be happy, you should be on time, you need to take better care of yourself, I'm in your business. When I'm worried about earthquakes, floods, war, or when I will die, I'm in God's business. If I am mentally in your business or in God's business, the effect is separation. I noticed this early in 1986 when I mentally went into my mother's business, for example, with a thought like my mother should understand me. I immediately experienced a feeling of loneliness, and I realized that every time in my life that I had felt hurt or lonely, I had been in someone else's business. If you are living your life, and I am mentally living your life, who is here living mine? We're both over there. Being mentally in your business keeps me from being present in my own. I am separate from myself, wondering why my life doesn't work. To think that I know what's best for anyone else is to be out of my business. Even in the name of love, it is pure arrogance, and the result is tension, anxiety, and fear. Do I know what's right for me? That is my only business. Let me work with that before I try to solve your problems for you. If you understand the three kinds of business enough to stay in your own business, it could free your life in a way that you can't even imagine. The next time you're feeling stress or discomfort, ask yourself whose business you're in mentally, and you may burst out laughing. That question can bring you back to yourself, and you may come to see that you've never really been present, that you've been mentally living in other people's business all your life. Just to notice that you're in someone else's business can bring you back to your own wonderful self. And if you practice it for a while, you may come to see that you don't have any business either, and that your life runs perfectly well on its own. Meeting your thoughts with understanding. A thought is harmless unless we believe it. It's not our thoughts, but the attachment to our thoughts that causes suffering. Attaching to a thought means believing that it's true without inquiring. A belief is a thought that we've been attaching to, often for years. Most people think that they are what their thoughts tell them they are. One day I noticed that I wasn't breathing. I was being breathed. Then I also noticed, to my amazement, that I wasn't thinking, that I was actually being thought, and that thinking isn't personal. Do you wake up in the morning and say to yourself, "I think I won't think today"? It's too late. You're already thinking. Thoughts just appear. They come out of nothing and go back to nothing, like clouds moving across the empty sky. They come to pass, not to stay. There is no harm in them until we attach to them as if they were true. No one has ever been able to control his thinking, although people may tell the story of how they have. I don't let go of my thoughts. I meet them with understanding, then they let go of me. Thoughts are like the breeze, or the leaves on the trees, or the raindrops falling. They appear like that, and through inquiry we can make friends with them. Would you argue with a raindrop? Raindrops aren't personal, and neither are thoughts. Once a painful concept is met with understanding, the next time it appears, you may find it interesting. What used to be the nightmare is now just interesting. The next time it appears, you may find it funny. The next time, you may not even notice it. This is the power of loving what is. Becoming aware of your stories. I often use the word story to talk about thoughts or sequences of thoughts that we convince ourselves are real. A story may be about the past, the present, or the future. It may be about what things should be, what they could be, or why they are. Stories appear in our minds hundreds of times a day. When someone gets up without a word and walks out of the room, when someone doesn't smile or doesn't return a phone call, or when a stranger does smile, before you open an important letter, or after you feel an unfamiliar sensation in your chest, when your boss invites you to come to his office, or when your partner talks to you in a certain tone of voice. Stories are the untested, uninvestigated theories that tell us what all these things mean. We don't even realize that they're just theories. Once, as I walked into the ladies' room at a restaurant near my home, a woman came out of the single stall. We smiled at each other, and as I closed the door, she began to sing and wash her hands. What a lovely voice, I thought. Then as I heard her leave, I noticed that the toilet seat was dripping wet. How could anyone be so rude, I thought. And how did she manage to pee all over the seat? Was she standing on it? Then it came to me that she was a man, a transvestite, singing falsetto in the women's restroom. It crossed my mind to go after her, him, and let him know what a mess he'd made. As I cleaned the toilet seat, I thought about everything I'd say to him. Then I flushed the toilet. The water shot up out of the bowl and flooded the seat, and I just stood there laughing. In this case, the natural course of events was kind enough to expose my story before it went any further. Usually, it doesn't. Before I found inquiry, I had no way to stop this kind of thinking. Small stories bred bigger ones. Bigger stories bred major theories about life, how terrible it was, and how the world was a dangerous place. I ended up feeling too frightened and depressed to leave my bedroom. When you're operating on uninvestigated theories of what's going on, and you aren't even aware of it, you're in what I call the dream. Often the dream becomes troubling. Sometimes it even turns into a nightmare. At times like these, you may want to test the truth of your theories by doing the work on them. The work always leaves you with less of your uncomfortable story. Who would you be without it? How much of your world is made up of unexamined stories? You'll never know until you inquire. Looking for the thought behind suffering. I have never experienced a stressful feeling that wasn't caused by attaching to an untrue thought. Behind every uncomfortable feeling, there's a thought that isn't true for us. The wind shouldn't be blowing. My husband should agree with me. We have a thought that argues with reality, then we have a stressful feeling. And then we act on that feeling, creating more stress for ourselves. Rather than understand the original cause, a thought, we try to change our stressful feelings by looking outside ourselves. We try to change someone else, or we reach for sex, food, alcohol, drugs, or money in order to find temporary comfort and the illusion of control. It is easy to be swept away by some overwhelming feeling, so it's helpful to remember that any stressful feeling is like a compassionate alarm clock that says, "You're caught in the dream." Depression, pain, and fear are gifts that say, "Sweetheart, take a look at what you're thinking right now. You're living in a story that isn't true for you." Caught in the dream, we try to alter and manipulate the stressful feeling by reaching outside ourselves. We're usually aware of the feeling before the thought. That's why I say the feeling is an alarm clock that lets you know there's a thought that you may want to do the work on. And investigating an untrue thought will always lead you back to who you really are. It hurts to believe you're other than who you are, to live any story other than happiness. If you put your hand into a fire, does anyone have to tell you to move it? Do you have to decide? No. When your hand starts to burn, it moves. You don't have to direct it. The hand moves itself. In the same way, once you understand, through inquiry, that an untrue thought causes suffering, you move away from it. Before the thought, you weren't suffering. With the thought, you're suffering. When you recognize that the thought isn't true, again, there is no suffering. That is how the work functions. How do I react when I think that thought? Hand in the fire. Who would I be without it? Out of the flames. We look at the thought, we feel our hand in the fire, and we naturally move back to the original position. We don't have to be told. And the next time the thought arises, the mind automatically moves from the fire. The work invites us into the awareness of internal cause and effect. Once we recognize this, all our suffering begins to unravel on its own. Inquiry. I use the word inquiry as synonymous with the work. To inquire or to investigate is to put a thought or a story up against the four questions and the turnarounds, explained in the next chapter. Inquiry is a way to end confusion and to experience internal peace, even in a world of apparent chaos. Above all else, inquiry is about realizing that all the answers, we ever need are always available inside of us. Inquiry is more than a technique. It brings to life from deep within us an innate aspect of our being. When practiced for a while, inquiry takes on its own life within you. It appears whenever thoughts appear, as their balance and mate. This internal partnership leaves you free to live as a kind, fluid, fearless, amused listener, a student of yourself, and a friend who can be trusted not to resent, criticize, or hold a grudge. Eventually, realization is experienced automatically as a way of life. Peace and joy naturally, inevitably, and irreversibly make their way into every corner of your mind, into every relationship and experience. The process is so subtle that you may not even have any conscious awareness of it. You may only know that you used to hurt, and now you don't. You're either attaching to your thoughts or inquiring. There's no other choice. Chapter 2. The Great Undoing. The one criticism of the work I consistently hear is that it's just too simple. People say freedom can't be this simple. I answer, can you really know that that's true? Judge your neighbor, write it down, ask for questions, turn it around. Who says that freedom has to be complicated? Putting the mind on paper. The first step in the work is to write down your judgments about any stressful situation in your life, past, present, or future, about a person you dislike or worry about, a situation with someone who angers or frightens or saddens you, or someone you're ambivalent or confused about. Write your judgments down just the way you think them. Use a blank sheet of paper, or you can go to thework.com to the section called The Work, where you'll find a Judge Your Neighbor worksheet to download and print. Don't be surprised if you find it difficult at first to fill out the worksheet. For thousands of years, we have been taught not to judge, but let's face it, we still do it all the time. The truth is that we all have judgments running in our heads. Through the work, we finally have permission to let those judgments speak out or even scream out on paper. We may find that even the most unpleasant thoughts can be met with unconditional love. I encourage you to write about someone whom you haven't yet totally forgiven. This is the most powerful place to begin. Even if you've forgiven that person 99%, you aren't free until your forgiveness is complete. The 1% you haven't forgiven them is the very place where you're stuck in all your other relationships, including your relationship with yourself. If you are new to inquiry, I strongly suggest that you not write about yourself at first. If you start by judging yourself, your answers come with a motive and with solutions that haven't worked. Judging someone else, then inquiring and turning it around is the direct path to understanding. You can judge yourself later when you have been doing inquiry long enough to trust the power of truth. If you begin by pointing the finger of blame outward, then the focus isn't on you. You can just let loose and be uncensored. We're often quite sure about what other people need to do, how they should live, whom they should be with. We have 20/20 vision about other people, but not about ourselves. When you do the work, you see who you are by seeing who you think other people are. Eventually, you come to see that everything outside you is a reflection of your own thinking. You are the storyteller, the projector of all stories, and the world is the projected image of your thoughts. Since the beginning of time, people have been trying to change the world so that they can be happy. This hasn't ever worked because it approaches the problem backward. What the work gives us is a way to change the projector, mind, rather than the projected. It's like when there's a piece of lint on a projector's lens. We think there's a flaw on the screen, and we try to change this person and that person whomever the flaw appears to be on next. But it's futile to try to change the projected images. Once we realize where the lint is, we can clear the lens itself. This is the end of suffering and the beginning of a little joy in paradise. People often say to me, "Why should I judge my neighbor? I already know that it's all about me." I say, "I understand, and please trust the process. Judge your neighbor and follow the simple directions. Here are some examples of people you may want to write about. Mother, father, wife, husband, children, siblings, partner, neighbor, friend, enemy, roommate, boss, teacher, employee, coworker, teammate, salesman, customers, men, women, authorities, God." Often the more personal your choice is, the more potent the work can be. Later, as you become skilled in the work, you may want to investigate your judgments about issues such as death, money, health, your body, your addictions, and even your own self-criticism. See Chapter 6, Doing the Work on Work and Money, Chapter 7, Doing the Work on Self-Judgments, and Chapter 11, Doing the Work on the Body and Addictions. In fact, once you're ready, you can write about and inquire into any uncomfortable thought that appears in your mind. When you realize that every stressful moment you experience is a gift that points you to your own freedom, life becomes very kind. Why and how to write on a worksheet. Please avoid the temptation to continue without writing down your judgments. If you try to do the work in your head without putting your thoughts on paper, the mind will outsmart you. Before you're even aware of it, it will be off and running into another story to prove that it's right. But though the mind can justify itself faster than the speed of light, it can be stopped through the act of writing. Once the mind is stopped on paper, thoughts remain stable and inquiry can easily be applied. Write down your thoughts without trying to censor them. Sit with your pen and paper and just wait. The words will come, the story will come, and if you really want to know the truth, if you're not afraid to see your story on paper, the ego will write like a maniac. It doesn't care. It's totally uninhibited. This is the day the ego has been waiting for. Give it its life on paper. It has been waiting for you to stop just once and really listen to it. It will tell you everything like a child. Then, when the mind is expressed on paper, you can inquire. I invite you to contemplate for a moment a situation where you were angry, hurt, sad, or disappointed with someone. Be as judgmental, childish, and petty as you were in that situation. Don't try to be wiser or kinder than you were. This is a time to be totally honest and uncensored about why you were hurt and how you felt in that situation. Allow your feelings to express themselves as they arise without any fear of consequences or any threat of punishment. People who have been in the work for a while get pettier and pettier on their worksheets as they try to find the sticking points that are left. Beliefs just get more subtle, more invisible as problems dissolve. They're just the last little children calling out, "Yoo-hoo, here I am, come and find me." The more you do the work, the more uncensored you become and the pettier you like to get, because it becomes hard to find something that will upset you. Eventually, you can't find a problem. That's an experience I hear from thousands of people. Write down the thoughts and stories that are running through you, the ones that really cause you pain, the anger, the resentment, the sadness. Point the finger of blame first at people who have hurt you, the ones who have been closest to you, people you're jealous of, people you can't stand, people who have disappointed you. My husband left me. My partner infected me with AIDS. My mother didn't love me. My children don't respect me. My friend betrayed me. I hate my boss. I hate my neighbors. They're ruining my life. Write about what you read this morning in the newspaper. about people being murdered or losing their homes through famine or war. Write about the checker at the grocery store who was too slow, or about the driver who cut you off.